when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think, I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down.
I'm sick of your lies.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
In face of democracy, very good.
Mark Kenny with you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri First Nations people, and of course ANU's Australian Studies Institute and the School of Politics and International Relations, from whence comes Dr. Maria Taflaga. Hi, Maria.
Oh, hello, Mark. How are you?
I am very well, thanks, on this first day of Parliament. And also with us is Professor Frank Bongiorno. Welcome back as always, Frank.
Oh, thanks, Mark. Lovely to see you.
Now, I don't think you've been on Democracy Sausage since the advent of the Fifth Republic. That being the election of the Albanese Labor government, and already it feels like sort of a different country, doesn't it?
It does, and I guess now with the sitting of Parliament, that those differences will be dramatised. But you run into Canberra public servants, and they seem at least under the impression for the time being that they might actually be able to achieve something as they go forward, and that's a nice feeling, I guess, if you've been a public servant in this town for some years and have felt as if you're running into brick walls.
Yes, there's many things around. Of course, as I say, we're speaking on Tuesday as we're recording this, and the Parliament has been going through through the sort of early stages of quite a lot of ceremony that marks the opening of a new Parliament. I wonder if I could ask you, this is probably an unfair question in a sense, because it's asking a historian to sort of weigh events contemporaneously, and we haven't seen how they play out and so forth. But how significant is this change in a historical sense? We don't see it happen very often, opposition parties winning from government. I sort of joked about it being the Fifth Republic, but... Mm. Which of course, there is now going to be, there is a minister for the Republic, which is an interesting development in itself, has some monarchist complaining that, suddenly there's a minister of the crown dedicated to the removal of the crown. Nice line, nice try. But nonetheless, fifth in the sense that there's only really, Labor's only done it five times. This is the fifth time. So it's a hard thing to do, to come from opposition into government. And, I've witnessed that process in 2007. I don't remember it from 1996. I mean, I wasn't in attendance. It's a big thing.
It is a big thing. Yeah, they don't happen terribly often, and they're even less frequent for Labor. So yes, the change of government matters, and we'll see how much it matters, I guess, in the time ahead. I mean, at the moment, the government looks to be very much a captive of forces, mainly beyond its control. Some of them are inherited problems from the last government. Some are problems that are simply a part of the global environment at the moment. But in some ways, the change of government is the least of it, really. I mean, that was an earthquake election. We now have a primary vote in this country divided into three more or less equal parts, and that is extraordinary. That's never happened before, not since the arrival of the two-party system in 1909, 1910. And it'll be incredibly interesting and stimulating, I think, to see how that plays out in the parliament, but also in the electoral politics ahead too. So, you know, how will Labor work with or against the Greens and vice versa? What role will the Teals play in this? They don't have the numbers to hold the balance of power, but they are clearly a force to be reckoned with even without those numbers. And will Labor be able to leverage agreements with the Teals against the Greens when they go to the upper house with legislation? How this all works out, we just don't know at this stage. And then, of course, you have a Liberal Party that is in, I would have thought, the deepest crisis really since the 1940s. And again, that will also be absolutely fascinating.
Yes, Maria, it is interesting, isn't it, to think about this in terms of, well, that challenge for the Liberal Party now plunged into opposition with a great deal of alacrity, even if the new government wasn't embraced with the same sort of alacrity, because as Frank said, there was a sort of a spraying of the vote, a sharing of it between these thirds rather than, you know, the normal kind of binary, I suppose, that has characterised Australian politics for a century or more. But nonetheless, there is that deep problem for the Liberal Party, and there's that sense that things have changed. We don't know if they've changed permanently, of course. We don't, you know, that turns on what happens at the next election, what happens between now and then, what happens at the next election. You know, I raised the question in a piece I wrote recently about, you know, what is the most significant change here? The arrival of the Greens finally into sort of the lower house in numbers, which is a significant development. After talking about it for a long time, it's finally happened with those three seats gained in Queensland. But the Teals as well, I mean, they've eaten into the Liberal Party vote in its most treasured heartland. So big changes.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And honestly, I don't think I could compete with Frank's elegant summary there. But I guess what I would add is this election's really interesting because it's sort of, if you think about it, kind of made visible some processes that have clearly been a long time in the making. On my bookshelf, I have a copy of the 1990 election study kind of review done by academics, and that was declared environment election, which I'm no doubt will amuse you, Frank, given what sort of since happened and the role that Graham Richardson played in, I guess, making the environment an issue, which Hawke was able to beat Andrew Peacock on. But if we look at, I think you raise an interesting point there, Mark, and I would say two things about it. Like, if we look at the Teals and the Greens as a block, right, a sort of an environmental block that actually sort of cross cuts traditional materialist cleavages around income, then yeah, like I think this is an important potential turning point. I do think it is predicated on obviously what happens at future elections. But to sort of circle back to what I was trying to say at the very beginning, this election seems to have finally crystallized long-running processes around the way Australia's electoral system works, right? So one of the few quote-unquote laws that we have in political science is called De Verger's Law, and it basically says that the electoral system drives the party system. So if you have a majoritarian party system, like you do in the UK, for example, like you'll produce like a two-party stable majorities at least. And in Australia, we have our Senate, which is proportional, as everyone knows who listens to this podcast, but that actually creates a different logic, right? And what has been really interesting is that over decades, we've seen the Australian population come to understand this. And it seems like that sort of sensibility that people have developed in the Senate, we've been voting in different ways in the House and the Senate for at least 30 years now, longer, and the parties have come to accept that. But we seem to now be transferring some of this desire and some of this understanding and manipulation, strategic voting in the lower house too. And so it will be really interesting to see how parties respond. It'd be really interesting to see how the Liberal Party responds, given that their role as the official opposition remains in place, but their, I guess, you know, dominance and weight that you would expect to have as the sort of official opposition isn't quite there in the same way, you know, because the chamber has been rebalanced to these, you know, the significant crossbench, including the Greens.
I really like that that term you used, crosscuts, crosscutting the sort of materialist income balance or whatever it is of the electorate. There's a sense in which climate was the sort of crystallizing issue that, you know, for that process, so that we get this. When we look at what one of the things we can clearly say out of an election that seemed quite turbulent in its result, quite mixed across the nation, was that there was a consistent vote for candidates who were looking for serious action on climate change. There'd been a lot of discussion about this for a long time, but suddenly we had candidates, whether it be Labor candidates advocating the 43%, which the government is now seeking to, you know, bring into law, whether it be the Greens advocating a stronger position, the Teals advocating a stronger position, other community candidates advocating a stronger position. Very strong, sort of almost, you could say, sort of two-thirds of the electorate, somewhere like that. It's probably a bit of an exaggeration because there are, of course, you know, One Nation and other independents that were contesting the election. But nonetheless, very clear sort of delineation there in terms of the issues, even if it led to a much more mixed picture in terms of the electoral result, Frank.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it was a landslide election against the coalition and against a lot that the coalition stands for. And absolutely. I mean, I wrote a piece shortly after the election in which I said, you know, this was in many ways the most significant shift to the left since the combined elections of 1969 and 1972. And part of my reasoning there is the way in which that issue of climate change and energy policy has become a defining issue in Australia, probably in ways that is unusual, you know, or ways that are unusual internationally, but it is an absolutely defining issue, separating kind of left from right. And essentially the Liberal Party made it so when they selected Tony Abbott as their leader more than a decade ago. And I think if we look at things broadly in that sort of way, it was a shift to the left, but yes, a particular kind of shift to the left in which the issue of climate change was critical. The other issue, of course, is integrity and corruption. I mean, the two issues where I think you could say that there is an overwhelming mandate for action are those ones around climate change and around an anti-corruption commission and a broader redesign of you know, the integrity systems at the Commonwealth level. And I don't think anyone's going to be able to get around that. That also poses real challenges for the coalition because they're probably now reconciled to the Anti-Corruption Commission, although they'll no doubt have plenty of things to say about its detail along the way.
Particularly its ability to investigate retrospectively things that have happened previous to the law coming about.
Yeah, there'll be issues around that, although in a sense that might be avoided simply by the expedient that Labor appears to be adopting, which is not to define a kind of a sort of retrospectivity at all, basically to leave that to the commission when it's formed. I think that's Dreyfus's position at the moment, as I understand it, and that may obviate some of those issues. I think there are likely to be bigger arguments around the whole issue of public hearings, which has always been, it's long been controversial in relation to the New South Wales ICAC, and there'll be a lot, I think, still to be said around issues of reputation and so on that tend to come up in that sort of context. But that said, a strong anti-corruption commission and strong action on climate change were surely the two things that came out of that election, and any backsliding around that, I think, is going to exact a pretty heavy electoral price for anyone who tries it in the time ahead.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that the coalition set itself or couldn't resist the temptation to sort of go for that retrospectivity when calling an inquiry. I mean, if you recall, there was the inquiry into the home insulation scheme.
Yes. And
then I've forgotten precisely what the union-based one was about in its specific terms, but
the
I think that AAW one was also...
The AAW Royal Commission.
Yeah. Was that to do with the... you know, Gillard's building stuff.
Well, it was the whole issue of trade union corruption. And it delved back into things that Julia Gillard had done as a lawyer in the, early 1990s?
Correct,
So, yes, I mean, the coalition isn't on very strong ground in complaining about retrospectivity, I would have thought. Yeah.
Though I doubt, given one of the admirable qualities is the sort of lack of shamelessness, I doubt I doubt this will restrict them in their maneuverability and decision making. But yeah, I think what you said, Frank, is really kind of important, right? And that's because, you know, climate change is like just much bigger than the environment. You know, like I made reference to that book from 1990, and the environment really then I think kind of meant, you know, like green spaces and picking up litter and, you know, a little bit about water, right?
Yeah.
You know, and now climate change is about the future of the economy, about human health, and about how society is like going to be organized, given that whole swathes of places where we have built homes may actually not be able to sustain them because they are inundated repeatedly or they are too close to habitat and burn.
Yeah, and when we talk a lot about disruption, we've been talking about it for the last couple of decades. But I mean, climate change is the ultimate disruptor. It's a killer. It's a bringer of tragedy on a colossal scale. And we've seen that. We've seen recently with the heat waves in Northern Europe for example, and Southern Europe as well, particularly many people dying, far more people dying from heat waves than die through extreme cold events. This is a thing that often escapes attention because it happens over periods of time and in kind of really geographically disaggregated ways. Whereas, with a storm or an earthquake or whatever, you get this sort of death toll the next morning. And I'm not sure what the process is there, but in terms of the human psychology of it, but we seem to kind of, underappreciate just the damage of those things. And of course, we've seen in this country, devastating floods following not so long after devastating bushfires. We know that climate's changing all over the place. And this is a major disruptor. As you say, Maria, you get these whole areas now which are uninhabitable and people holding houses there that are uninsurable because no one will write insurance for a house that's got a high chance of being washed away or being inundated or something. So,
and there's also, consider climate change's entanglement in the biggest foreign policy and security issue that Australia faces, or foreign policy issue, I should call it, that Australia faces, and that's relations with China.
Mm.
Obviously there is a great game going on in the Pacific of rivalry between China and the West for influence. And that issue is utterly entangled in the existential threat that climate change poses to Pacific Island nations. So the way in which it seeps into apparently virtually every aspect of government policy is quite striking. And that's certainly a part of its complexity, but also its urgency.
Yeah. And in a sense, I suppose we're all saying this, but that's really what this election did, is that it sort of marked the moment at which climate change became undeniable across all these other metrics as well. It just became this issue that finally, after a long time, overwhelmed even what was beginning, already an evident cost of living crisis. That was always the big, the big block before, that you could get people to be concerned about climate change, and Labor and the Greens and others have had this problem through successive elections. You could get people to be concerned about it, but only up to the point where someone then said, this is going to cost you more, your energy prices are going to go up, or, your fuel prices are going to go up, and it started tumbling down the list. But here we had a situation where a cost of living crisis was already underway. The government had acted to extend the low and middle income tax offset. It had, halved federal fuel excise to get it through the election and so forth. These were real reflections of the cost of living going up. And yet at the same time, Australians voted quite decisively, as you say, to address this climate change issue, because it is no longer one that you can pretend can be dealt with later, or that can be dealt with by someone else.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think I mean, it was that issue that got shortened, wasn't it? Do you remember the question of the 2019 election, how much are your policies going to cost?
What are they going to do? Yeah. What's your modelling say about what it will do to economic growth? Yeah. And he just didn't really have an answer. Yeah.
And in a sense, that question has kind of become redundant because of the, again, the complexity and existential character, I think, of the issue.
The thing that worried me about the way Labor handled that at the time was that the answer was actually a completely legitimate question. What's the cost of not acting? That's what they should have been saying much more forcefully. The cost of not acting on climate change is significantly greater than what we were proposing. And bear in mind, Labor took a 45% by 2030 cut to the 2019 election and had a lot longer to make the adjustment between 2019 and 2030 than we have in 2022, where Labor's proposal is 43%, pretty much the same. And gets it through an entirely better process that Labor went through this time. It had the support of the BCA, the National Farmers Federation, the Australian Industry Group. These are the major employer groups, as well as the ACTU and others. So there was a much better process of kind of girding this policy, of rooting it in, of founding it in consultation, getting sort of widespread buy-in for it, and then being able to take it forward. Let me just move quickly to a break, and then we'll come back and continue this discussion.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, we were talking about climate change. Let's stick with that for a moment, because this discussion between the government, Maria, and the Greens is quite an interesting one. There's not just in terms of the detail, which we can get into if you like, although there's not a lot around about that, but about the atmospherics. If we compare what is happening now to what happened in 2009, for example, when the Greens held their position, did not vote for Kevin Rudd's carbon pollution reduction scheme, and we know a whole series of events cascaded after that, delivering us Tony Abbott and a decade of denial and everything. On this occasion, Adam Bandt is saying that his position on Labor's 43% cut is, you know, they want it to be a floor rather than a ceiling. In other words, the minimum that the government achieves by 2030 and that government can go further. But he goes into it with a mindset of we want our disposition is to pass with improvements. So he at least rhetorically, at least in a sort of a public relations sense, and let's hope there's more to it than that, but there's certainly know that they can't just be purer than the driven snow and just not be prepared to negotiate. And to Chris Bowen's credit, he's also saying, well, if people come to us and they can suggest ways in which we can be even clearer about what we're trying to achieve, we're very open to listening to that. So there's a much better sense of constructive dialogue going on. Perhaps it does reflect the huge mandate that the Australian people have given legislators to actually finally get something done in this space, but it's quite different, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like structurally, I suppose, you know, Rudd was interested in securing an agreement with Turnbull, you know, in the original CPRS construction, and that's actually where all the negotiations were really occurring and why the, you know, the target was 5% at the time, but the whole point of it was that it sort of effectively had a ratchet in it. It was like a framework which you could essentially add a ratchet to legislatively at a later date, even though I don't think it actually had an explicit ratchet in the legislation at the time. And I think this is this debate comes at a really interesting moment for the Greens, right, who are, as a party, you know, there is an internal debate going on within the Greens around, you know, I guess, you know, which happened before this result, around how they kind of conduct themselves. Because I think if we look historically, the Greens have not been a very constructive or successful actor within the political space. If we compare them to other green parties around the world, you know, and the German Greens perhaps being the best or the most constructive, the most successful.
When you say successful, just to interrupt briefly there, you mean successful in terms of changing laws. You don't necessarily mean successful in terms of holding on to their electoral wedge or their electoral, you know, slice of the vote. They've been quite successful in that regard, haven't they?
I'd say so. Though, you know, I mean, like their vote has kind of bounced around. But yes, they have done a good job in sort of sustaining themselves. But I guess that's the thing about green politics, right? Like the joke about the Greens is, you know, that they're watermelons, green on the outside, red on the inside. And that's glib and actually not true. It really depends on the jurisdiction and the parts of, you know, whichever part of the Greens, like, you know, in specific parts of the country. But there is that sort of tension between, I guess, the old sort of left, Trotskyite left, that sort of split off from Labor and kind of found a home in the Greens around its sort of social politics and its sort of social welfare politics. And then there are, you know, the advocates who are, I guess, more interested in the environment and that difference between deep Greens and light Greens, you know, like Greens that essentially sort of looking for ways of looking for economic solutions to environmental problems, and deep Greens who sort of think we should recast the sort of ecological way we organise society.
And there are those Greens who actually have an aspiration to eventually be a party of government.
Yes.
And those, for that, and, that and those are likely, pragmatism. Yeah, that's right. Those are likely to be more inclined towards making incremental progress to establish a broader electoral base. And I suppose it's going to be fascinating to see what happens to the Greens as a result of having made these incursions in Queensland. So there are now four lower house MPs. And those MPs are going to have to, you know, they represent a broad electorate, a broad geographical electorate, rather than a sliver of the vote that the Greens have largely survived on getting to elect senators. These are lower house seats, and they represent, you know, as I say, a cross section of the population. And it will be fascinating to see whether that changes the character of the way the Greens approach some debates.
Well, yeah, and to be perfectly blunt, you know, outside of Adam Bandt's seat, like the Greens won these seats where there wasn't a Teal independent. And it remains to be seen whether or not if a Teal independent showed up, whether or not people would actually vote for that Teal independent over the Greens because of the question mark over the Greens' pragmatism and whether or not they are considered to be a reliable holder of the reins of governing power, that is, whether or not they are responsible actors. And, you know, if we look historically, the Greens have sort of struggled with incremental change, right, which cumulatively can add up to a great deal, but which involves selling out because you don't achieve everything that you want to. And that's the great strength of the Greens, is their sort of ideological passion. And that's why they've been able to pick off Labor votes, right? But that's also their kind of weakness, which is potentially what will stop them from being able to take a greater role at the heart of government. And that's the sort of conundrum that they're facing. And so it will be interesting to see how much of the sort of saber rattling around no new coal mines, well, what that actually translates into, and whether or not the Greens can actually manage that big debate internally over whether or not making deals with Labor that don't achieve everything the Greens want will actually be kind of palatable.
To be fair, though,
it's so difficult to understand, though, as well, because they're not transparent. Sorry, Mark, please.
Oh, no, no, I'm sorry, I was interrupting you. I was just going to say, to be fair, though, no new coal mines makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's not a silly policy. What's actually logically silly is the idea of pursuing emissions cuts whilst adding to them. Egregiously, and some of these proposals would do so. So there's a logical consistency to that position. It's just a question of how you actually deliver policy, how you make the adjustment. This is a bigger question, I suppose, for all lawmakers and political parties, is how do you actually manage, steward the transition from the fossil fuel-based economy that we've had to the clean energy economy of the future with the minimum disruption to the economy and to local economies, which is an important thing, particularly because we have geographical electorates, and also to the stability of the energy system and you know, that has real implications as well. So,
I think that's exactly right.
They're legitimate concerns.
Yeah, so I guess let me rephrase the issue then. Do the Greens create enough space for Labor to be able to actually deliver no new coal mines in effect rather than in name? So
yeah.
The Greens might pursue changes to environmental law that makes the ability to approve these mines very difficult, and that's the same effect as no new coal mines without saying to the, the kind of constituencies that might vote coalition, that are currently held by Labor, that, you know, there's no future for your industries, right? Like, there are ways and ways.
There are. Let's pivot from the Greens to the coalition, the opposition now. Peter Dutton made it very clear straight away after the election that he wasn't going to be supporting the legislating of the 43% cut that Labor had been given a mandate for. There are some Liberals, Andrew Bragg, Senator from New South Wales, who has reserved his position, wants to see the legislation. Bridget Archer, the moderate, one of the few remaining moderate Liberals, lower house member for Bass in Tasmania. She's also been very clear about this. She did an excellent interview this morning that I heard where she, basically supports faster action on climate change. She speaks from Tasmania, where they have a lot of renewable energy, of course. I'm wondering, will this end up being a rod for Peter Dutton's leadership? For a start, as we've been discussing, the whole sort of zeitgeist in this country has shifted, and the coalition was rejected largely on this ground. I mean, there was a few other solid grounds on which to reject it as well. I'm just wondering, was this just blunt oppositionism and his bad instincts taking over?
Yeah, and I suppose it raises the question, is he fighting some past war that is animated by the success of Abbott as an opposition leader? Well, that was only ever a half success because it was a term as opposition leader that didn't prepare them very well for government. But certainly the success Abbott had as a destroyer of Labor governments a decade ago must be a powerful sort of example, I suppose, or exemplar for a hard man of the right like Dutton, whose instincts are politically belligerent anyway. But look, the world's moved on, and that was a pretty decisive result in favour of strong action on climate change. I mean, Dutton will be gambling, I suppose, on a very unstable strategic and economic environment internationally, shifting views around this.
The cost of living crisis continuing, Ukraine continuing, energy prices becoming more and more a front of mind issue for people, and voters then perhaps blaming the government for ideological policy rather than for protecting their hip pockets. That sort of standard kind of that was essentially the formula that Abbott was following, wasn't it? It's interesting, Maria, that John Howard, Tony Abbott, and Amanda Vanstone, all names from the past, addressed the Liberal Party room yesterday. Might have been this morning actually, and as we speak, you know, gave them wisdom on how to get through opposition, how to keep your chin up and how to fight your way back. But I don't know, as Frank was just saying, you'd be wanting to question pretty solidly the relevance of Howard. I guess it was Howard Mark II speaking rather than the first time he was opposition leader, which was a debacle. And Abbott, well, let's face it, if he's going to relive the Abbott years, that's not going to be pleasant for anyone.
Yeah, actually, you know, John Howard addressing the party room is really kind of interesting, because if we look at, I suppose, comparative periods of opposition, there is a lot more in common, I think, with the 1983 result right now than there was after 2007. Like 2007, that loss in many ways reminded me a lot more of what happened in 1972, and the opposition ended up behaving in a similar manner to what it did in 1972. And by that I mean it boiled down to them not really accepting that Labor had a right to rule because of the minority parliament in effect in the first case, because, you know, how dare people elect Labor? They've been captured by madness.
Many people just couldn't imagine it. I mean, it's been since 1949 the coalition had been in charge. So,
Exactly. And you know, and there wasn't really any sort of serious thinking about what a coalition government would look like, and the Fraser years, beyond the sort of bedding down of some of the sort of social policy reforms that Whitlam had introduced, and some significant moves on multiculturalism and rhetoric around small government, you know, the Fraser government didn't achieve very much. What was really challenging, I suppose, for the Liberals in the 80s was that, you know, Labor moved to kind of really occupy their ground, and in some ways, And a large part of that was due to events. Like, global events had simply played out. We'd had, you know, it was a decade after the oil shocks. It had broken the old consensus. You know, people were living through a recession with, I think, near 10% unemployment. Frank will know the exact number. You know, people were ready for a change, ready for something new. And I think we've sort of reached a similar point in the zeitgeist. Now, people kind of understand that things simply cannot return to the state that they had been. Too much has changed.
Yeah.
You know, things need to be different. But what I suppose is potentially kind of really interesting is that, you know, Albanese is a prime minister from the left and Dutton is an opposition leader from the right. And, you know, and like the coalition is pretty much dominated by the LNP. You know, that party room is overwhelmingly dominated by the LNP. The Nationals are a huge block in the joint party room now, comparative to the rest of the group.
Yeah, because they didn't lose any seats, whereas the Liberal Party got sort of gutted in its homeland.
Yeah, that's right. Like, if you look at their holdings in New South Wales and Victoria, I mean, I think they might just WA. Add up to what they hold, exactly, what they hold in Queensland. So. You know, so I think it will be really interesting to see whether or not a leadership team of two men from Queensland can work out a way to talk to enough of the rest of the electorate in the rest of the country. Because, you know, their strategy is pretty obvious. They, best case scenario, they win government. But, you know, like, a good win for them would be reducing Labor to minority by picking off some of Labor's outer suburban seats.
It worked in 2010, didn't it? 2009, when Abbott took over from Turnbull, and they reduced the. I mean,
I think Labor did that to themselves. Well,
a little help from the Labor Party, but
yeah. I think you know, like, lots of people like to blame the Greens for failing to support the CPRS. But honestly, why didn't Rudd back his own policy? Why didn't he go to the electorate?
Why didn't he call a double dissolution election?
Precisely. Yeah. You know, yeah. I still think he wears most of the blame for that.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. But, I mean, there was a fair bit to be said for the role of climate change policy in that whole unwinding of Rudd's leadership. I mean, I was at Copenhagen in 2009, shortly after that was initially voted down. And, you know, there was a sort of an unravelling of the government then. People went into the Labor Party. People went into the Christmas period thinking that Rudd was going to emerge from that summer break and call a double D, and they were going to fight it on climate. Instead, he'd written a children's book, and And then he said, you know, what had been the Great Moral Challenge suddenly became something you could park. And, you know, things unfolded from there. You know, you don't know at any given moment what the impact of your actions are down the track as a political party. But I think looking back on it, we can see at least a causal relationship between a series of decisions in which you know, I think crucially begin with the failure of the CPRS and with a whole bunch of sort of bad decisions that happened.
Absolutely. Totally a sliding doors moment.
Yeah, yeah. Look, just in the time we got left, Frank, I mean, going off Maria's point about, you know, those historical comparisons, Anthony Albanese has very strongly referenced 1983 himself. He's picked up some of those ideas of Bob Hawke, the idea of unity as distinct from division, that Fraser had been a divisive prime minister because, of course, he got there by the most divisive way possible, the constitutional crisis in 75. And that really framed his persona for that whole 7.5, 8 years that he was the prime minister. Bob Hawke comes in, the great conciliator. It's all about the slogan was bring Australians together or bring Australia together. There was summits. And it seems like Anthony Albanese has sort of tried to reference a number of those things. We know we've got a jobs summit coming up in September. He talks about unity. He was saying it in his speech to caucus on Monday of this week. He said it again at the launch. He's talking about the Uluru Statement from the heart as a unifying moment and framing the Republic push down the track after that as a unifying moment. There are elements, it seems to me, I'm sorry about the length of this question, there are elements, it seems to me, about Albanese's early persona that he is drawing the good parts from the three prime ministers, or the four, I suppose, you know, to some extent Whitlam's passion, Hawke's cabinet government and consensus and all of that sort of stuff, and then the lessons of where Labor kind of went off the rails in the Rudd-Gillard period, and he was, you know, kind of one of the few people trying to really hold it together during that period, and he's trying to alchemize all of that into a new and successful political formula.
Yeah, look, Mark, I think you sum it up really well. Yeah, I mean, clearly draws something from Hawke. The Hawke the Hawke Keating era generally remains attractive to a Labor leader because of the electoral success. Labor's never been more successful electorally at the national level than during those years. And the capacity of those governments during the 80s and early 90s for reform that, you know, as each government got in, they achieved something new. I mean, Keating was still doing it in the early 1990s. So that's attractive if you want to change the country. Yes, the Jobs Summit probably owes something to the National Summit of April 1983 in its kind of
and even the climate change policy, as we've discussed before. You know, the way he pulled warring interests together in order to find a compromise position people could live with, and then takes that forward. So there's a legitimacy in that.
There is, but look, I actually think he's in a lot of ways more a child of the Whitlam era. He was a protege of Tom Uren, who perhaps more than most members of that government represents the kind of expansive, ambitious aspect, you know, in Uren's case, particularly around urban policy. Albanese does talk about universalism in a way that's, I think, reminiscent of Whitlam. I'm thinking there particularly of aspects of their childcare policy, where it was most explicit. And I just think generally there is a consciousness, partly through his own personal background, of which he's had, you know, he's said a lot about it, about the importance of public goods, actually. You know, in a way that's, you know, not some sort of reheated Whitlamism, but I think that exemplar remains actually quite important to him emotionally and also to some extent intellectually too. There were times during that campaign where he sounded like, he sounded unlike any other Labor leader since Whitlam, actually, and that surprised me. I only really noticed it quite late in the campaign, particularly around discussions of childcare. They've got this problem, of course, that they're wedded to a more regressive income tax system, and that is really I mean, the most appalling economic management when you consider income tax is an instrument of macroeconomic management. Mm. And, you know, we're about to cut taxes in an inflationary environment. It is crazy. It's a shocker. But they're wedded to it. They're wedded to this politically. I mean, it's 1993, 94 that is the exemplar for them there, where, you know, the tax cuts that the Keating government abandoned, and they don't want that to be used against them politically. So
yeah,
they remain committed to them. They will be an incubus, though.
This is the LAW tax cuts that 1 minute were law and then were later abandoned.
When Dawkins was treasurer, absolutely.
Yeah. No, it's a good point, Maria, isn't it? There is, but you know, that universalism that Frank talks about, there's some Keating in there as well. I mean, you know, around the universalism of superannuation, for example, and framing childcare as very much an economic policy, removing a capacity constraint within the economy.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I'm looking forward to them doing this so we can actually move on to a proper discussion around, you know, childcare, right? Like, yes, sure, it's all about empowering women and getting them back into the workforce. But, you know, the reason why Scandinavian countries have the sort of gold standard parental leave arrangements is because it actually recognizes the reality of what it's like to have young children, and that is that they get sick all the time. And that's why it's a 2-year period where both parents are basically encouraged to take leave. So I look forward to getting this done so we can then actually move on to the next stage of this policy discussion, which acquaints itself with reality.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Well, look, it's been a terrific discussion. There is so much more to discuss, and we're going to be discussing it over coming weeks and months, because many of these things, as the government tries to move forward, will be, will have their difficult moments and have their complexities. As we said at the start, there's a giant crossbench now in the lower house. The government, of course, has a majority in its own right. So numerically, they're important, but morally, they are very unimportant, but morally, they're quite significant. I know the government has rearranged the schedule so that a number of those Teal or new community candidates can give their first speeches on the first Tuesday night, which is tonight as we record this, freeing them up then so they can participate, having done their what used to be called maiden speeches. They can then participate in the debate around the 43% climate target or emissions target and on other things. So I think, you know, notwithstanding the friction over staffing, the government will be well advised to be taking very seriously the electoral and moral heft that these new crossbenchers represent. And we'll see, as we discussed at the start, whether they're a permanent feature or not. I think most of those people will be, because they're just going to be very good candidates and MPs. Thanks again for your participation, Frank.
Thank you, Mark.
Always great to have you along. And thank you, as usual, Maria.
Oh, thank you, and welcome back to work, Frank.
Oh, yes, it all began yesterday. Thanks, Maria. Yeah.
Long may it be so.
Yeah.
Okay, that's Democracy Sausage for this week. Look forward to your company again next week. Thanks to the Crawford School of Public Policy, which, of course, facilitates this podcast each week. They have brilliant resources and expertise that they bring to bear to make this happen, and we thank them from the bottom of our hearts. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.